This is the Simon Dell Show, where we take a deep dive into some of the week's most notable business and marketing stories and interview high-performing business leaders and marketing professionals to find out their lessons for success.
That element of persistence and hanging in there and, you know, just grinding away and finding a way, that will be the difference in the end. When you're teaching, every day is a sales process.
I would think of 1,000 things I'd buy rather than watch a soccer game.
Welcome to the Simon Dell Show, episode number 3030. We have made it to number 30, would you believe, from all those months ago, back in November, or was it October of 2017, when we started this journey together. For those of you that are new, welcome to the show. My name is Simon Dell, believe it or not, it's on the name of the podcast. And I am a digital marketing consultant based in Australia, Brisbane, Australia, but work absolutely everywhere with clients from all over the world. This is my podcast. We're going to do it in two sections. The first section is going to be called something, sorry, is called something. Start that again. This section is called the first section. Oh, this is all going horribly wrong here. The first section is called The Spin Cycle and features both Dr. Edwina Luck from QUT and Patrick Condren from Channel 7. And we're going to talk this week about Oprah Winfrey. We're going to talk about the World Cup. And generally, it's 20 minutes of three grown adults arguing with each other. So if that appeals to you, then definitely tune in. If that doesn't appeal to you and you want something slightly more intellectual, stimulating and useful in your life, then tune in to the interview that we have with a gentleman by the name of Ryan Handley. Now, Ryan is the CEO and he is the co-founder of an app called Travello, which is a social media app for travelers, believe it or not, hence why it's called Travello. Interesting story how he got into that, some of the challenges that he faced on the way, how he's achieved growth with that business, which I think is a real key factor. But generally just a really all-round interesting chat. So please listen to him, and all his contact details are in the show as well if you want to talk to him and ask him any questions after that. Before we get into the spin cycle, there are a few housekeeping bits. The guy who puts this show together, well, in fact there's two guys now, and I really should give Dan a little bit of credit. Dan, our producer, who organizes all of our guests and so on, he's on daniel@simondell.com if you fancy being a guest. And then our producer Gilberto, the podcastboss.com, if you're interested in producing your own podcast. So that's them out of the way. The next thing is to rate and review us. If you listen to us on iTunes, please go onto iTunes and give us a rating and a review. We would much appreciate that. And finally, if you want to get hold of me, if you want to talk to me, if you want to ask me any questions, if you're interested in my business side of things, simondell.com. You can find me there or email me at simon@simondell.com. I'm also on LinkedIn, Twitter, our Instagram page on Instagram. Where else would it be? Our page on Instagram, The Simon Dell Show. If you can come and follow us there, that'd be great. And yeah, pretty much most social media, you just find me by typing in Simon Dell. Please come and talk to me, whether it's a business or whether it's just about the podcast. Let's come and have a chat. So without any further ado, let's get into this week's Spin Cycle. We are back with episode number 30 of the Spin Cycle. And as usual, I have the penalty shootout of co-hosts, Dr. Edwina Luck from QUT, and the video assistant referee of co-hosts, Patrick Condren from Channel 7. Welcome, you two.
The lack of enthusiasm in your voice is telling.
Yeah. Well, the lack of enthusiasm for you two as well was
must be,
like, you know.
You are
must be
joking.
World Cup time, is it?
That's the worst segue
wow.
ever.
That was terrible, Eddie.
Oh, I thought it was
what was
so.
The giveaway, Ed?
I don't know. Well, referee.
Oh, dear God. Yeah. Anyway. So Optus have announced today that they will be handing over all of the streaming for all of the World Cup group games to SBS because they have royally fucked it up.
They
And my question to you guys is, does this, as a general indictment of the brand, like, fuck up the whole brand?
Well, I've never had much time for Optus anyway. And I was, like a gentleman on Twitter, I was genuinely surprised to hear that they had
the rights.
A pay TV leg of the – I just assumed it was always going to be on SBS. But, you know, Optus covered in poo, SBS covered in glory.
It's interesting, isn't it, that – well, maybe I'm not looking in the right place, but I – have not seen any advertisements, or even a month ago, like subscribe here to the World Cup. And I don't know if you boys have, or if any of the listeners have.
I've not seen a thing, but yeah. Then it's soccer, so the vast majority of Australians would not be looking for anything.
But they would be. So. No, they are.
Oh, I do. I absolutely do.
But they've said that.
Mate, I was in the pub on Saturday night watching the Socceroos lose to France, and mate, you don't get that. You just don't get that atmosphere in AFL. Anyway,
so there was in direct response to me saying that the vast majority of Australians wouldn't care about the World Cup, you said I don't think so, and by way of benchmark, you quote an experience in a pub in Brisbane.
Yeah.
Is that? I'm just trying to get some clarity.
Yes. What, 24 million people?
That is my scientific method.
I'm just trying to get a bit of clarity. The only two people I know who are interested in the World Cup are both Poms, my next door neighbour, and Simon Dell.
Or Europeans. No, look Optus.
Anyway, back
Optus
to back to
I still maintain. I still maintain
a big following.
That the vast majority. I'm not saying it hasn't got a big following, but I stick by my claim that the vast majority of Australians don't give a tinker's cuss about the World Cup. There will be pockets.
People are going to be stopping listening to this podcast now. Oh.
Well, hang on. You've got to assume that they started in the first place. But leaving that aside, what I would say is it's a in Australia, it's a boutique code for the most part because it is soccer.
Right. I've got
and
the numbers.
And I don't think that
– Good. I'm glad
oh, have you
do.
Yeah. Nearly
off you go then.
Nearly 7 million Australians watched the Socceroos' last-minute loss against Italy back in 2006. Mm. That's 7 million over 12 years ago.
30% of the population. Okay.
Which is not the vast majority.
Oh, it's still a lot.
Well, I didn't say it wasn't a lot.
Let's remove people who are too old to watch the TV or too young to watch the TV. And I think
how can you be too old to watch the TV?
Well, you know what I mean. They've gone to bed. I don't know. The point is that
have you been drinking? That was Ed's job.
There is. I reckon you're talking about 50%. I reckon you're getting up to 50% of the population.
Oh, pig's ass. No, I agree, Simon.
You are making it up to justify. You are creating dodgy stats to back up your sad argument for your national code in England.
If
it was so good, why do you live in Australia?
Oh, stop.
Right, anyway, let's move on because if we're going to start getting into some sort of xenophobic argument here.
Two things. Optus paid approximately $8 million, so the Australian Fin Review said, for the broadcasting rights. Now, that is a lot of money for only a little amount of people that watch this sport. And even if they don't watch it and they don't follow it, they follow – Australians love their sporting code. You must agree with me there, Pat. They love sport. So they are going to watch this game with their friends in the pub even if they don't really, really follow this code. And the other point is that –
It's not at 4 o'clock in the morning then,
aren't you? Oh, no, it wasn't that when Australia played France. I can get to tell you because I watched it as well. And I am not – I was when I was – kid, I loved Manchester United, and now I had to watch the game because Australia was playing. Anyway, my second point before you interrupt.
I think that as Simon, for a change, quite correctly pointed out, that gets us off the topic completely. But didn't Optus buy the rights from SBS? Didn't SBS sell them the rights?
No, SBS had a sub-license from Optus.
Okay, because SBS couldn't afford to buy the rights themselves because the rights were too expensive.
I think Optus walked in with a big checkbook and said, we want the rights. Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
So Optus as a brand, given we're talking about marketing, has cocked it up and it's on everyone's lips. People are more aware of Optus. Is this a situation where a cock-up gives them good publicity? I don't think so. Has SBS covered itself in glory? Absolutely. And particularly when you wrap it around the debate of the Liberals' main policy-making body on the weekend wanting to privatise the ABC. Here we've got an example of a commercial, of a taxpayer-funded broadcaster stepping in to help out a commercial entity whose technology basically wasn't up to the task of the money that it paid for.
To be fair, SBS 4 years ago had a really good run at the World Cup and they did a fantastic job. Great technology, great. I think SBS know what they were letting themselves in for, whereas the best Optus had to measure against was some big Premier League matches that they've been streaming over the last couple of years. So I think SBS, I think what the fail here is that Optus should have sat down with SBS and day one of getting the rights and saying, what are we going to let out? What are we letting ourselves in for here? What sort of infrastructure and technology do we need to be able to successfully carry this sort of thing off? And just pray that SBS would be nice enough to tell them. So,
and if it was the blockbuster sporting event that some people believe it to be, Telstra and Channel 7 or Channel 9 would have been would have been bidding for the broadcast rights, not a minor telco and a boutique free-to-air pub broadcaster.
Don't think that's true. But anyway, Ed, you were going to make a second point, Ed, before Pat rudely interrupted. If you can even remember what it is.
I was glad that Malcolm Turnbull stepped in to affix the coverage. But the second point was that with the change of viewers that we have worldwide, not Australia now, so we've got two-thirds, the stats say that two-thirds of the population are going to watch it on TV, but we've got the digital environment that it has grown so much over the past 4 years. So people are not just watching it on TV and in hotels and pubs, but they're watching it on their mobile and digitally as well. So this is a big factor that we've got to consider, because this is so much, it's part of our world. It's part of our, you know, we carry our phone, we carry our tablets, we carry everything around with us now, so we can view anything anywhere. And I suppose Optus were probably hoping for that.
I watched the highlights of, I've watched all the highlights of every game so far on my SBS app on my phone. And, you know, we're talking 2 minutes highlights. So, that, you know, it's not taking me a long time, but I'm doing that wherever I am at the time. Mm. The other interesting stat I saw is what people are doing whilst they're watching the games. Because obviously we know that in the last sort of 10, 12 years, that kind of two screen thing has been a big factor, that people watch one thing, but they're doing something else at the same time. It turns out that some of the statistics coming out of the World Cup say that 51% of people are using social media whilst they're watching the game. And me, for one, watching the England game on the other night, we actually had a messenger group, Facebook messenger group of all the guys that I play football with, all the English guys that play football with, discussing the game as it happened.
Yeah. Twitter used to fill that space.
Yeah, it did. But now I'm actually doing it in a group of people that I give a shit about, as opposed to the random, you know, intelligentsia on fucking, you know, or pretend intelligentsia on Twitter.
Wow. But
the other interesting thing that
have you been off your meds today?
Thankfully, nobody else on Twitter will ever hear that. But the other thing that I thought was really interesting in terms of the stats was that there's actually 28% of people are looking for things to buy on the internet whilst watching the World Cup.
Stop.
Why wouldn't you?
Well, I wonder if they're doing soccer-related things or just random stuff.
Well, that would be interesting. Are they buying a sofa because they hate the sofa they're sitting on at that time?
Correct. I would think of 1,000 things I'd buy rather than watch a soccer game.
Isn't that surprising for you to say that, Pat?
Yeah, you're not really.
A penis ring, for example.
Why would you suddenly say that?
I would
because I'd rather slam a knob in a car door than watch a game of soccer.
Do you know, Simon, you know, I'm...
Perhaps you're the wrong person to have on this episode.
I'm thinking 51% of
you
people...
You just want sycophants who...
on social media. I would have expected more, Simon, with those figures. I would
really?
Have, yeah, I would have expected a lot more. I mean, I know people are engaged in a game, but you're chatting with your friends all over the world because this is the most... watched and loved sport worldwide, Pat. I hate to tell you that, but this is.
I think. Yeah, I think the thing I was going
to
say.
I've got no complaint about that. That and you don't have to hate to tell me. I accept that completely. That soccer is the world game.
Let's cut him out of the conversation because he does. He's not even watched the thing, so it's like.
Oh, hang on. I beg to differ. I once appeared in a international Budweiser ad.
Oh, here we go.
A World Cup.
Oh, yes.
He hasn't brought that up.
A soccer
while,
World
he?
Cup.
Hey, now, speaking of beer, have you seen any advertising during the World Cup at all about anything, whether it's online or on SBS or...
I can't say I have, actually. There's nothing that I would stand out to me and
when
go,
did it started on the weekend, didn't it?
Last Thursday.
And I watch a bit of SBS on demand.
You love
and
SBS.
And they, you know, pepper the ads in there. But I haven't seen anything. There's World Cup coverage, but nothing within, you know, on SBS. And I haven't been watching Optus.
This is the thing
Optus,
that I
but
think
I presume
is
Optus would have had to sell.
Well, you'd think so, wouldn't you? You'd think Optus would be crying out for it. But, I mean, this is the biggest sporting event after the Olympics. So where are the brands? Where are... And maybe I haven't seen enough TV. Maybe there's no billboards. There's no, maybe they're in the Qantas magazines. I don't know, but I'm just flabbergasted.
Absolutely. And I take your point, but to me, it further underlines the fact that brands in Australia, because of the lack of appeal of the World Cup, aren't interested in advertising their product on it.
I don't think that's the case at all because there's plenty of brands that want to get involved in soccer. But what I think is happening is, number one, the two things. Number one, FIFA has got somewhat still of a dirty name. Mm. And, you know, I think there's a lot of brands that are a bit standoffish about it at the moment after all the Sepp Blatter stuff and all those kind of things. And the second thing is I think brands struggle to find value in a traditional, 30-second slot in a halftime, you know, show. So I think a lot of brands are sitting back, going, "Do we spend $5 million on doing this, or $10 million, or whatever the cost is for this, or do we do something a bit more engaging and interactive with our audience?"
I'm sticking with my view that. During the Olympics, which is obviously the highest, most watched sporting event in the world, there's plenty of advertising for brands in the Olympics. There's plenty of advertising. There was when the Commonwealth Games was here this year.
It's a bit hard you giving us an example as you haven't actually been watching it. So it's like, you know.
Well, hang on. You blokes have, and I've offered an alternative point of view. That doesn't make me either A, wrong, or B, a bad person. It's just an alternative point of view. Which in this democracy, demos the people, Kratos to rule, I'm allowed to do.
Well, I wonder if...
Yeah, we all know what a shambles democracy really is, but anyway.
Well,
I'd have to look at Donald Trump. And you know, as one of only two Australians in this conversation...
I am an Australian. Anyway, Edwina, what were you going to say?
I was going to say, well, maybe Russia is... has. I agree, FIFA, the brand FIFA has definitely got a bit of...
Yeah, maybe it's. I know where you're going with this. Maybe it's Russia as well that's got a bit of a.
Well, it's an unknown. It's, you know, there's a lot of Australians over there, and we've seen that on the footage. We've seen it on Twitter. We've seen it on Instagram. There's a lot of marketing going on, but it's under the radar. It's not above paid for. Apart from the big brands, you know, like Nike and Visa, Adidas. So I wonder if there's been problems with Russia allowing advertising to...
Yeah, that's a good point.
Well, you know, like to be filmed. Yeah. I've read somewhere that brands have been sort of stopped from filming things or not even allowed to film. And so, but then that gives way to viral advertising. That gives way to, you know, quirky stuff that I haven't seen yet. So
how could Russia stop Nike advertising in Australia, the World Cup, as part of the World Cup? I don't understand how they could do that.
What I think Eddie's saying is because of the challenges of, you know, perhaps marketing in Russia, that brands have maybe given it a bit of a wide berth this time round. You know, I understand your point about how it affects what's happening in Australia, but I just wonder whether all brands are sort of taking a step back from the whole thing this time round, whether it's in Australia or whether it's in Russia or US or wherever, that perhaps they're sort of thinking, yeah, all right, let's maybe skip this one. Maybe step, well, but,
and,
this one
and
out.
Then again, if for example, Nike made that decision for whatever reason, because, you know, FIFA's on the stink and not Russia's on the stink, wouldn't that then create an opportunity, a hole in the advertising wall for someone like Adidas or Slazenger to step in and say, well, we're going to...
I think there's still official brands of the... Anyway, we could talk about this for hours, but one of the other things I wanted to touch on before we go is that I read this week that Oprah Winfrey has been signed up by Apple TV to head up some of their shows of their streaming service. I found that quite interesting because this week we got Amazon Prime in Australia for the first time. So all those people
What is Amazon Prime? Is that some sort of what's that show the kids watch where the trucks turn into monsters?
No, that's Optimus Prime in the Transformers. Oh, Optimus Prime. Fuck Christ.
Close.
Jesus fuck.
Did you say Optus Prime?
Optimus Prime.
On the World Cup?
We've gone fucking full circle here, haven't we? No, Amazon Prime is the premium version of Amazon. So if you can order anything on Amazon, and normally in the US you get next day delivery. Here it's going to be 48-hour delivery. You also get access to their streaming TV service, which has got loads and loads of stuff on that I'm not going to start listing. But you also get access to all special deals and promotions and blah, blah, all those kind of bits and pieces. And it's like $4.99 a month.
Oh,
at least the trial version is $4.99. Yeah,
that's
absolutely
free. Oh, my goodness me. That's ridiculous.
It's a $5. That's a schooner in a pub a month. Do you know what I mean?
It's a bargain. Or it's a cup of... It's a double shot coffee for those who aren't obsessed with the drinking culture. I thought you'd given up the drink.
Do you know what? I'm rarely drinking at the moment, but that's not the point. So the interesting thing I thought was is that whether Oprah is going to be a big enough name to actually bring some attention to Apple TV, or whether the Netflix and Amazons of this world already have that area kind of sewn up.
Well, Apple doesn't have a back catalogue. They've got nothing.
No.
But it could. So what do you? They have to produce either a gazillion hours between now and launch of original content, or they have to buy a back catalogue from somewhere.
But to be honest with you, Pat, the amount of money Apple has buying a back catalogue is probably a drop in the ocean for their their cash. Yeah. It's not going to
sure.
They could just buy one of the major film studios and have all of their back catalogue. So
even with their $9 million fine this week.
What do they get a $9 million fine
for? Sorry, I'm going off topic.
Yeah, completely.
Yeah, no, don't worry about that. We'll talk about it next week. No,
no, I like that because I hate Apple.
Oh, do you? Okay. Oh, let's not start that. Let's not go down that again because we go, oh, God. We've had Apple and soccer. We really should not have had Patrick on the show this week.
Wow. Okay. That's fine. Well, look, I only come because of the vast amount of money you pay me.
It was free things that Sun gave you.
Anyway,
we get no free things. We get nothing.
Is Oprah Winfrey a big enough draw to make Apple TV into something serious?
At first blush, and I'd say, you know, so what? You know, the Obamas, Netflix has got the Obamas. Yeah. I'd rather watch them than Oprah, particularly if they're involved in, you know, on-camera stuff.
Yeah.
But Oprah doesn't do it for me. So my view is, you know, if it's... Like you, Amazon Prime, that's my next job to sign up for that, for $4 a month.
Yeah, it's amazing. Yeah.
To see what's on there.
Yeah. There's a 30-day free trial as well, Pat, so you can knock yourself out.
Okay, my two cents is that it's a great teaser. It's a really good hook. Get them in. If you know, any demographic, people know Oprah. She's just incredible when it comes to awareness. So that's what they're trying to do. They're trying to create awareness. Perfect. But
in America, which is
them, nah,
where she's been.
She's loved here. Qantas bought her out a couple of years ago with John Travolta.
Yeah, she did. That went bonkers, didn't it? Everyone was trying to get tickets.
Yeah, but I don't think Apple signed Oprah Winfrey up because of her appeal in Australia. I think they've signed Oprah Winfrey up because of her, primarily because of her appeal in America, because it's an American company. Beg your pardon?
We're a drop in the ocean here. We're, 24 million?
Yeah, gotcha.
Yeah. But, you know, she's a great hook.
Well, nice. Fancy that. Different opinion from you two. There you go. Who would have thought that was
We could be a conga line of suckoles lining up behind you, but then where would that get us?
Yeah, it wouldn't be a very interesting show then, would it? Mm. On that note, thank you very much for both of you for coming this week, even though...
Holy.
One of you didn't really want to be here, but you know,
I did want to be. Edwina is always happy to come. What? The dog's growling now because she's made too much noise.
No, we've set the dog off. Right. Anyway, talk to you next week.
Bye.
I'm joined by Ryan Hanley, who is currently the CEO and co-founder of Travelo, an app for social network for travellers. It's used in about 180 countries around the world. Are there actually 180 countries
there
in the world?
There actually are, yes, believe it or not. A couple of small provinces on top of that.
I thought it was 192.
Yeah, so there are 192 or 194, and then there's a few little provinces that claim to be countries.
We'll work out in a minute which ones you're not being used in. But anyway, so to finish the introduction, Ryan is a former gym owner and also a PE teacher. So we're going to give him some shit about that. But welcome to the show, Ryan.
Thank you, Simon. It's great to be here.
So which countries are you not currently
used
in?
That's a very good question. And I actually don't know the answer, but I might actually find out now because I'm interested.
I'm going to take a stab that one of them might be North Korea.
Yeah, I'd say it'd be North Korea. Actually, while we're talking, I might even check that up. But I know we can visually see where our users are, and they're in some insane places, like literally in war zones. And, you know, we got users in Mosul, in, you know, all these crazy places. So, it's really interesting, actually.
Well, we'll talk about a little bit more about the app at the moment, because obviously that's the main focus for you. But I just want to sort of take a step back. The first question I ask everybody who's on the show, what was the first job that you got paid for?
First job I ever got paid for was when I was probably, how old was I? I think I was in grade 6 or 7. So I was at about 11 years old, and I was working for $3 an hour. Helping an old guy just do general stuff. He was a bit of an eccentric, and he used to bottle fruit and kind of do odd jobs. And you think back now and you wonder how your parents actually let you, you know. I grew up in Mackay, which is a, you know, reasonably small town, and this guy basically put an ad out looking for helpers, and mum goes, that looks like a good idea, and I get sent to an old guy's house, and it was really nice. You know, he was a great guy, and, you know, we did some interesting stuff. But, yeah, $3 an hour.
It's weird because that's, as you say, that sort of thing today would be, you know, completely frowned upon. You know, strange old guy wanting, you know, young boy around his house.
It's quite sad, really, that whole thing. And on a bit of a tangent, but, you know, because he was just like a really great old guy, a little bit eccentric, but he just needed help. And as you said, now, you know, we'd unfortunately look at it, you know, in a completely different way and be very skeptical. And that's probably a sad indictment on the world.
What you're a QUT alumni, aren't
you?
What got you there? What drove you to do that?
Probably chance and getting to the end of grade 12 and going, what the hell am I going to do? And where should I go? I would imagine. Actually, my first year of university was at the University of Queensland, actually. So I went over to UQ because I enjoyed sport and didn't know what I wanted to be. And so I did human movements, not even knowing what it was. And then I got to the end of the first year and I still didn't know what it was. And so I kind of thought, hey, I could be a PE teacher. And as soon as I never actually considered it. And then as soon as I said it, it was a bit of an epiphany and a bit of a light bulb moment. I thought, yeah, so this is what I want to do, and changed over to QUT after that first year.
What were you a sporty guy at school?
Yeah, I mean, I wasn't an exceptional sportsman, but I liked sport and I liked what kind of sport represented, you know, being with your mates and teamwork and all those types of things. So I always enjoyed that team environment, always played heaps of sport, and still try to.
So the career as a PE teacher.
Yes.
And I've got to say, everybody who listens to this probably had a favorite PE teacher and a nightmare PE teacher. Where were you on that?
I would say it depends who you would ask, you know. I think it's one of those things, you know, you really gel with some kids and others you don't. But I think on the majority, I think I was fairly well liked, and you know, but it's always a worry when you're a teacher, because we always say, you know, too well liked, it's probably a sign that you're doing something wrong. So it's a bit of a fine line, but no, I think most of the kids like me. I still see plenty of them out and about these days, and you know, most come up and say good day and we have a good chat, so fine.
What was it that triggered you deciding that wasn't what you were sort of destined to do?
It wasn't a decision, actually, because I actually really enjoyed it. And I've said this to quite a few people a number of times. Teaching wasn't actually something I was looking to get out of. It wasn't something I was jaded with. It wasn't something I didn't enjoy. And I know that happens to a lot of teachers, but I actually really enjoyed it and I found it really rewarding. And the school that I was at had a great staff, and some of my best friends, you know, are still there, and I'm the godparents of people that are still there, and they're the godparents of my children, things like that. So it wasn't something that I was actually looking to get out of. This opportunity just came up, and I kind of figured that it was something that I had to explore further, because I did know that, you know, teaching it would always be there. I was in middle management, so I was a head of department. So you know, I was walking away from a little more than just a straight teaching job. But, yeah, it was more that this opportunity came up and I thought, you know, I've got to have a crack at this, basically.
How did it all happen? What was, like, you know, was someone approaching you? Did you, you know, how did it sort of land on your lap?
For Trevello, going full-time.
No, because you eventually went to Jets, didn't you?
No. So I was kind of doing that concurrently. My wife primarily runs that.
Oh, right. Okay. Yeah. Well, let me, because I want to talk about the Jets thing quickly before we jump into the Trevello thing. Because I think I'm just trying to think of the question I'm trying to ask you here, and I've been thinking about it all morning because running a gym is a challenging business.
Yeah.
What I do you know, yeah, what? I really don't know. I'll tell you what, I made a broader question. How was the experience dealing with a franchise business like that?
We were in very early, so we got into Jets in the very early stages where they were probably finding their way and things like that. And it certainly changed over time, I would say that. Yeah. You know, as they started to grow bigger, you know, things changed within the business, as I assume they would in all businesses. You know, Brendan Levinson was the founder and CEO, and he was kind of a great guy. And then, you know, as it grew, you know, people came into the business who became the CEO, and he kind of, you know, he was always the leader of the business, but I think other guys were taking it in different directions and, you know, making sure it was a robust business. So it changed over time, but it certainly had its difficulties just because of the restrictions that are placed on you when you think something would work, but you can't actually implement those things. So that was one of the difficult parts.
Do you, obviously franchises are getting a fair knock at the moment.
Yeah.
You know, people like Domino's and 7-Eleven and things like that. How did you rate it as a franchise business?
Look, I think it was pretty good. I think it was pretty good. You know, it was a Queensland base. You know, they came out of the Sunshine Coast, so they were very grounded. It wasn't a franchise coming over from the US. That was, you know, cutthroat and ruthless from the start. So as I said, that was actually part of the reason that we chose it. It was Australian, Queensland, and you know, relatively local. The head office is still down at the Sunshine Coast. But it did change, and I think they do. I think it's the nature of the beast that the bigger they get, the more corporate they become, and then certain elements come into it that, you know, make it harder and more restrictive and things like that.
What was the biggest challenge running a small business like that for you guys?
It was when you had, I guess, a difference or an opinion on the way that things should happen, but you were obviously restricted in what you could actually do. So there's upsides because, you know, you get the benefits of the big brand and the operational structure and all of those types of things, but you are restricted when you think things should go one way and, you know, you're unable to take them that way.
It always feels to me like that job running a gym like that has got a very heavy sales focus. Is that something that you found?
Once again, it changed over time. So So the whole industry, the fitness industry, has really changed over the past 5 or 6 years. You know, when we first got into it, you just opened the doors, like literally. Then because Jets was the first 24/7 to come, if not the first, one of the very, you know, early guys to come into the 24/7 market. But then obviously, you know, in comes competition and plenty of it. You know, there was an oversaturation of the market probably 2 years ago where it was just ridiculous. It was just crazy. And, you know, gyms were popping up everywhere. And this is where another, you know, one of the areas where, you know, franchises can be a little bit reckless because, you know, it was just a land grab and they were putting up gyms in places that were just crazy to put them up and were already saturated and they didn't really have the interests of, you know, the franchisor at heart. It was just, you know, let's get as many of these stores up as possible. So there's been a rationalization since then, you know, and the smaller guys are starting to drop off and gyms are shutting and, you know, it's just a normalization of the market as there is in any market. But to go back to your question, it has become definitely more of a sales focus, but there's also a big part of retention. So, you know, a lot of it is on the whole customer success piece, you know, so customer service and making sure people are enjoying their experience and, you know, utilizing retention through those types of strategies.
And I think the question then that sort of leads me from that is that with the sales focus and the customer retention focus that you must have experienced whilst running a business like that, was that new to you? Because, I mean, I guess being a PE teacher, you know, that's not necessarily stuff that you don't necessarily need to learn those kind of sales skills or customer retention skills when you're educating kids.
You know, it's funny, but, and I've kind of looked back on this at hindsight, but when you're teaching, every day is a sales process. You're sitting in front of 30 people who don't really want to be there and you need to make it enjoyable, engaging, and, you know, a nice experience for them. So it's you know, once again, when I was there, you don't realize this, but I actually do look back on it now and you look at the way that you handle different people, you know, different kids, different styles, different learning styles, different engagement styles, and you go, you know what, I was actually selling something 5 or 6 times a day to people who didn't actually want it. And sometimes by the end of that, you know, 50 minutes, that they wanted it and they enjoyed it. So you're doing it without doing it. So you're picking up skills, you know, you're picking up skills that are transferable, which is probably, you know, most careers.
So when Trevello came along, what was the, was that someone approached you or that was an idea formed in a pub over a beer? How did that sort of all come about?
It was an idea. It was literally as simple as that. When I go right back to the very early roots, my in-laws were just bought a caravan and they were, you know, joining the grey nomads and starting to go around Australia, and they would go to these caravan parks. So they'd come home from their trip, but they'd say, you know, the best part of the trip was at the end of the day where you'd arrive at a caravan park And, you know, it was social hour. They'd ring the bell and they'd sit around in a circle and they'd talk and, you know, and they said that's where we get the best advice and tips about what to do is from people there. And I was thinking, well, how do you know when you turn up in that caravan park that there's someone, not someone on the other side of the caravan park that you just didn't cross paths with, but you're going to Alice Springs and they just came from Alice Springs and they could have really good advice for you or you could be friends, but you just didn't cross paths. And I was thinking, you know, there should be a solution for this. Maybe there's right. some sort of app or social network for caravanners where they can see what caravanners are in a caravan park so that they can connect up and get tips and advice and all those types of things. So that was kind of the really early premise, was this link around social and, you know, peer-to-peer sharing of information.
Was there a light bulb moment for that, or was that sort of an idea that formed over time, just, you know, you kind of testing it in your head over time?
It was definitely tested in the head over the time because, you know, I at that stage, I was not on Facebook. I was like the last person to adopt social networks, which is quite ironic now that I actually yeah. run. In fact, it was only once I'd really said, you know what, I'm going to go ahead with Travella. I'm going to make a social network that I thought I probably should join one of these things. So I literally wasn't on Facebook. I wasn't on Instagram, Twitter, you know, anything. I was actually a really slow adopter of mobile technology. You know, my friends used to, you know, I was the last one out of all of my friends to, you know, get a mobile phone and all those types of things. I traveled Europe and Africa and everywhere with, you know, no mobile phone and all that sort of stuff. So it's funny, I was a slow adopter of that. So when I came up with the idea, it did take a little while because I was like, you know, I'm a PE teacher, who does this? I've always kind of been into new ideas and a bit of a risk taker, but I didn't even know where to start with this one because it was just so far away from what I was doing. So it took a little bit of time and I thought about it. And I was just looking into the market and going, what's out there? I was kind of thinking, you know, something like this must exist. Yeah. I kept looking and it didn't. So eventually I thought, you know, if I don't do this, someone's going to.
But wasn't there – did Outbound come before Travello? What was the sort of sequence of
that? Yeah, that's right. So basically what happened was – over time, I kind of the idea evolved a little bit, and I thought, you know, this isn't just an app for caravanners. This can actually be an app for all travelers and backpackers because they all have that thing. You know, I thought back to when I traveled, and, you know, you meet great people in a hostel, and then all of a sudden you're off on a great adventure. But who else was in that hostel that I didn't miss, or who was around the corner? You know, that I just didn't see because I didn't cross paths with them. I didn't have that serendipitous moment. So I kind of, it was at this stage that I actually, you know, went to a couple of friends and kind of said, what do you think of this idea? And one of them was my now co-founder, Mark Cantoni, and had a bit of a chat with him and said, look, I've kind of got this idea for this app. You know, what do you think? And he was like, mate, this is good. And, you know, I would use this and this would have solved a lot of our problems when we were traveling. And so it went from there. So the name was one of the last things we actually came up with. We kind of went through this process of, you know, scoping it out, and we had absolutely no idea what we were doing. But we ended up with the name Outbound, but it took a little while to get there.
What was Mark's background?
Mark was actually by education, he was a surveyor. So did a little bit of engineering and he was a surveyor and he had started up a recruitment business and things like that. So he had a bit of business experience, but neither of us had any experience or skills, to be honest, in you know, travel technology and, you know, startup land.
So just so I understand, did Outbound morph into Travello, or are they two separate kind of entities?
No, so we launched as Outbound, and about a year after launch, we were contacted by a website in America called the Outbound Collective. It wasn't even an app, right. Just a website. And he's like, you need to change your name or else I'm going to sue you. I'm like, oh, wow, this is interesting.
Okay.
And a few people going, yeah, you've made it. Someone's trying to sue you.
Yeah, that's the signal that you've made it.
Yeah, trying to get sued. And anyway, so we went through this we went and got legal advice and you know, he kept at us and I learn a lot about trademarks in a short amount of time, but one thing about trademarks is that you can't actually trademark something that's descriptive of your service. So outbound is a word synonymous with travel, so no travel company can trademark it, hence the reason there's, you know, 30 or 40 companies with the word outbound in it. In fact, there's apps still in the App Store that have got the word outbound in it. But for some reason, this guy just wanted to go at us. And we got legal advice and, you know, found that out, that no one would be able to trademark it, including us. We'd be able to trademark our colours and logo in connection with the word, but not the word itself. Right. So we're explaining it to this guy and saying, look, you know, we appreciate your concern, but, you know, you're not even anything close to us. You're a website. We're an app. We have completely different demographics and focus areas. And, you know, there's nothing you can do here, basically. But he kept on complaining to the App Store.
Right, okay.
I'm writing letters to the App Store. These guys are infringing, they're infringing, they're infringing. And we were writing back to the App Store going, look, we've got legal advice saying that we haven't. And then one day, all of a sudden, we weren't in the App Stores, either of them. And basically, we were like, what the hell is going on here? It was a crisis moment because we were – at that stage, we were trying to raise investment. We were talking to these guys about strategic partnerships, and then we didn't even have a product in the App Store. And the balance of power quickly swung then. So the App Store's take was, look, we don't know who's in the right here, but until you guys work it out, we don't want to be a part of it, so you're taking our flat platform. So even though he was in the wrong, he was then in the right, and the balance of power shifted significantly. So we went and got legal advice and all those types of things, and the outcome was basically, look, guys, you can take this guy on and you're going to win the case. You will win because you're in the right, but it's going to cost you $80,000 to $100,000 to do it. Or you can change your name and get more security over it for, you know, $3,000 to $5,000 and get on with business. And it was a difficult decision. I wouldn't say it was an easy decision because, you know, you've got pride and you get your back up and you're like, oh, you know, let's take this prick down, basically. But, at the end of the day, we just need to get on with it. So that was the decision we came up with, which was the right one in the end. Once again, you look back in hindsight and, you know, it's good that we changed the name and we've now got, you know, full kind of ownership of the term and all of those type of things.
Does his website still exist and can we go and visit it?
It actually does, yeah. And you know, he's been through 500 startups and, you know, so he's not kind of a small player, but it's just that American culture that, you know, Australian people just don't have, you know, that sue first attitude. And he wouldn't talk to us. We actually were doing a trip over to, because he was based in the Silicon Valley over there, and we were doing a trip over there, and, you know, he wouldn't meet with us in person and all those types of things. So it's just a completely different culture. And we were on the end of it. But once again, you know, I think everything happens for a reason, and I'm glad we changed the name. I think we've got a better name and it's more defensible and all of those types of things. So yeah.
Where did the Trevelo name come from? Was that just, again, was that sort of a brainstorming session?
Yeah, pretty much brainstorming, but the breakdown comes from travel and hello. So bringing those two words together. So travel and hello together, and you end up with Trevelo. So it's just a bit of a brainstorm session, looking at a whole heap of, you know, you put 100 names down and find one sticks. So
I think there's a lot of startup and a lot of business people out there have been through that painful process.
Yeah.
It's was it all, everyone agreed? There was no kind of,
this
you know.
One was, yeah, there was, because, you know, you shortlisted and someone doesn't like this and I don't like that. But we kind of went that and we went, you know what, that's kind of, yeah, it sounds all right. And, you know, you can tell it's travel. And, so everyone was pretty happy with it.
So you've started that up. You've gone into business in a startup. What was those biggest challenges in the early days for you guys?
Everything, pretty much. You're pretty naive when we were naive going into it. You know, we didn't know anything about startups. We'd never read the Lean Startup and we'd never read any books. We didn't know anything about the, you know, the ecosystem or co-working spaces, any of that. So we just kind of jumped in there and did it. And, you know, I think there's actually some positives to that naivety, because to a large extent you don't know the rules, and so you don't know what you have to stick by. And so we were just like plowing ahead and making all these mistakes, but we were actually making progress, you know what I mean? And I think if we had of known the rules and the playbook, we would have taken a whole lot longer to get something to market and to kind of get it tested and those types of things. So I think there was a lot of naivety there, but once again, I think it worked in our favour because we didn't know the rules that we had to play by, so we just kind of went ahead and did stuff. And some of it worked, some of it didn't, but we got some answers and validation pretty quickly. And, you know, the whole thing about startups is basically getting it out there and getting validation and, you know, really kind of weird, kind of clunky way we did that, probably quicker than what we would have if we had have known the playbook rules.
Given that neither of you are developers, how did you tackle that side of things, finding someone that you could trust and that was actually giving you the right advice? Because I guess not only were you not developers, but your technical knowledge was, you know, a pretty big fat zero at the time.
Yeah, zero is probably overstating it. You know, yeah. we were literally Googling how to make an app, how to, you know.
Right.
And we ended up in agency land, basically, which is a very interesting place. And, you know, the who to trust thing is interesting because, you know, it's – when you've got someone from an agency building a product, there's never, ever going to be as much pride or diligence in the technical infrastructure as what you would put in yourself. So we didn't know what they were doing. We were like, we just want this app to do this.
Yeah.
And for the most part, there was some huge trials and tribulations through that process with the agency because, you know, their scope was pretty vague, and so then all of a sudden you've got misunderstandings about, you know, what things are supposed to do and what it's supposed to look like. So it was pretty heated, and we learned a lot through that process. But what we did get at the end of the day was something that worked and in the App Store in a relatively quick period of time.
Yeah.
And that was good because the startup playbook is find a technical co-founder and then, you know, build this out. And, you know, it would have taken us months and months, maybe longer, to find a technical co-founder who probably would have been doing this part-time at nights. Yeah. And it would have taken another 6 to 9 months to, you know, get it out. And, you know, everyone's still kind of working on it part-time. The one benefit of going to an agency is, yes, it was more expensive. But, you know, we could really treat them like employees rather than co-founders and crack the whip a fair bit and get something out in 3 to 4 months. You know, we had something which was good.
You don't have to answer this next question, but just for everyone out there who's thinking of going down that road and wants to build an app, what was your cost from day one through to that first iteration landing in the App Store?
Yeah, it ended up being somewhere in the – I think it was in the realms of 70 to 100,000.
Right.
Okay. I think it may have started at the lower and ended at the upper. But we had quotes – that was a while ago now, and we had quotes double and triple that.
Right.
And we kind of managed to stumble across some guys and who, you know, were happy to take it on. But most of – because that was for an iOS and Android app, which once again you're not supposed to do. You're supposed to just test on one platform, but we did that. And, so, yeah, it was kind of in that realm, which was – so Mark and I kind of – and neither of us are rich, you know, so that was a lot of money for us and huge risk. So we really kind of put our balls on the line and, you know, put a fair bit into it ourselves, which once again, you know, we retell that story to investors now and they like the fact that we did that and they like the fact that we put our own, you know, capital into it. So, it was an interesting experience working with an agency though.
Were you both in full time at that point?
Yes.
Yep. Okay. So you're not only paying that, but you've got to support yourselves as well.
Yeah. Oh, sorry. No, sorry. I thought you meant were you still working full time? That's
right.
Still working.
Oh, sorry. Yeah.
Yeah, sorry. Yep.
So this was being built whilst you guys were both still working?
Yep, that's right. Okay. So, and we were, you know, doing the night times and testing and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah, and I guess, again, when you look at the playbook, they always say, you know, someone's got to be full-time in it from day one and blah, 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 and all those kind of things.
Yeah.
You know, no, but I mean, you know, it's interesting. I haven't gone through all that myself. I look back and just go, you know, certainly the technical side of things for me, we actually had a, we had a technical guy working with us, but he'd never built an app before.
Yeah.
So, you know, it was almost like the blind leading the blind. We're all going, you know, what's the best platform for doing this on? And, you know, we were going, should we do it on just iOS first and then Android? And anybody you speak to, you just get about 1,000 different opinions, don't you?
Yeah, that's it. Yeah, absolutely. So it's really kind of, yeah, it's a really confusing process, probably for everyone, but particularly for us who didn't have that background or knowledge.
I think it's interesting, though, that you managed that. I mean, so it was 3-4 months to get a working product out there?
Yeah.
I mean, that's pretty fast. I mean,
it was. But that's, you know, they don't want the longer they have to spend on it, and this comes down to, you know, the quality that you end up with at the end of the day, but the longer they spend on it, the more it costs. So they are all about getting it in and getting it out. And that's kind of the only redeeming quality of going, you know, via an agency is they won't stuff around. You know, they'll want you out the door and out of their hair as quickly as possible.
Would you do it differently then if you were – If you had to start all over again, would you avoid that agency route?
I don't think so, because I think the only alternative was, as mentioned, trying to find, you know, some tech co-founders who were willing to do this, who had the time, and it just would have been slow. Like, we would have got there, but it just would have taken another 6 to 9 months, I think. So, you know, there's literally not a line of code left from that original app. You know, when we eventually got our tech guys in, they looked under the hood and just went, "Oh my God, we're not even going to try and build on this. We're just starting again." So that's like a shattering moment.
Yeah.
But you know, that's the way it works out.
I've forgotten what question I was going to ask you next. I had it right. That was it. I've got it now. So day one, you've got it there in the store. You know, you're high-fiving each other. You can see a product in the store. People can download it. What do you do next?
Yeah, well, it's funny when you're going through the development process, you're like, it was hard, you know, and we were having arguments with the agency and all of that sort of stuff. And, you know, it was really hard. And we just thought, you know, we can't wait. We're almost at the finish line. You know, we're there. Yeah. So this goes in the app store. It's feet up and, you know, kick back and relax. But it's, you know, it's not until you release it that you go, you know what, we're only just at the starting line. We weren't even in the race before. We've only, you know, just come to the first thing. So it was all about for us then trying to get early traction. You know, we're a social network. So those first few days, we, you know, once again, didn't follow the startup playbook and release globally as opposed to, you know, focusing in on, you know, one area like Brisbane or Queensland or Australia. We just thought, no, we've got a global product here, so we'll get it out there. So, you know, the first few couple of days, we got a social network with, you know, 5 people in it, 6 people in it, then, you know, 50, then 100. And, you know, social networks don't run with that fewer people. So, you know, it was all about trying to make sure that that engagement was there and making sure that people were interested in the concept and trying to get as many new people to join as possible.
And how did you do that? I mean, what were the key sort of marketing channels for you in those early days?
Yeah, we once again, I don't know whether it's good luck or good management. I think it was probably one of the few things we did kind of plan well for, is that we knew we did need some marketing channels, or we needed a community before we actually launched, because we didn't have any money. You know, I told you what it cost us before, and that was everything. That was everything we had. We didn't have any money for any sort of advertising or marketing at all. And we wouldn't have known how to do it anyway. We wouldn't have even known how to do Facebook or Google Ads. So what we did, which was pretty smart with the benefit of hindsight, is you know, right when we started building the app, so four or five months before we started building it, maybe even close to six, we started building up a travel community on Instagram and Twitter.
Right.
And we were just posting travel content and building up a following. And by the time we launched, we kind of had 5,000 or 6,000 followers on each platform. And what we were doing during that time as well was actually contacting travel bloggers, you know, heaps of them. So emailing them and saying, "Hey, look, we're doing this secret project, social network for travelers. We'd love your feedback on it. If there's features that you'd like to, you know, have included, let us know." And we kind of engaged with a couple of hundred of these travel bloggers, not asking for anything in return, just asking for feedback. And we kind of gave them the impression that they were part of this, you know, this secret, you know, project that was going on. Everybody really liked the concept. And we're like, you know, you've got to keep this under wraps because – and so they were giving us feedback, and I think because of that, they really kind of felt a bit of ownership of the project. And we never asked them. We never said, you know, can you do a review of this or can you spruik it for us once it launches? But the day before we launched, we basically got in contact, and I think by this stage we had, you know, 300 or 400, you know, on an email list. And this was just literally, it wasn't even MailChimp or anything. It was just like literally copy paste all of their emails and send it out. And day before we launched, we contacted them and said, look, thanks for all your help. Really appreciate it. Just letting you know, early access, that tomorrow we're launching. You know, thanks heaps. And within an hour of that email going out, we had, you know, announcements and reviews and all of these different things going out. And so we were starting, those guys were basically our marketing machine, which was really good for us. So that was, I think, a really smart play for us. So we had kind of this Instagram and Twitter community happening, and then we kind of had these travel bloggers on the side who were our mouthpiece to their audiences. So that helped us get some fairly early traction pretty quickly.
Those travel bloggers, you're saying you had a database of around about 300-400 by the time you launched. Yeah. What was the sort of response rate from them? I mean, I assume not all 300-400 were emailing you back, but you know, some of them sort of passively just accepting the information. But just a ballpark, what sort of success rate did you get with when you emailed these guys?
It was relatively high, to be honest, because the other thing we weren't doing was targeting the really big guys. Like, we knew they would either expect something in return or they just wouldn't return our email. There are a couple of big ones in there, but most of them were kind of what they refer to now as actually micro influencers. They've got under 10,000 kind of followers or engagements and those types of things. And so they're more open to things like this. And most of them like the idea and the concept, and they like the idea of being a part of it. So the response rates we were getting from emails and people doing beta testing and things like that was pretty pleasing, actually.
As it's grown, what have been the best channels for you for finding more people? Because I'm kind of guessing as a social network for travelers, there's a huge element of virality with it. People, you know, traveling and saying, I'm on this app, and they're obviously telling everybody that they're meeting and those kind of things.
Yeah.
Is there any other channels that work really well for you guys in terms of recruitment and new users?
Kind of in regards to ROI stuff, I would say we've run a number of competitions and they work really well for us because travel brands are happy to work with us because we've got a big audience, so they'll donate things. So we end up with these free prizes, which were pretty good, you know, trips around Europe and things like this that were worth, you know, thousands of dollars. And so we continued to build up our Instagram and Twitter following and our own database. And so then we could run these little kind of referral competitions. And if you do XYZ, then you're going to the chance to win this trip around Europe or Australia.
Right.
And because they cost us nothing and we were kind of, leveraging referrals and things like that, they were always kind of one of our best campaigns, and we continue to do that to this day, and they continue to be really good returns for us. As we speak, we're kind of running a big competition at the moment.
How were you approaching those travel brands to get those freebies? Was that just email them and say, you know, we've got X amount of 1,000 people on our, you know, in our network?
Yeah, pretty much. Just a little bit of hustle and, you know, just kind of writing emails, putting a heap of lines in the water, and, you know, heaps of them wouldn't reply at all, but a couple would, and then that's it. And then you'd get results. So you could go to another brand and say, hey, look, well, we did this with Busabout. Are you interested in doing this? And you've kind of got some runs on the board, so it grows from there. But, you know, it's a good you know, realistically, it costs these travel brands very little. You know, it's a seat on their bus or whatever it is on their tour. So it doesn't actually cost them much, and they get some pretty good brand exposure and those types of things from it.
How many people would they be reaching now so if there's people in the travel industry who happen to be listening and want to reach out, what sort of numbers are you talking?
It depends on the level of the prize, but, you know, it's in the hundreds of thousands, okay. You know, conservatively. You know, the one we're running now is a particularly, it's our kind of biggest one ever, and we'd expect to get, you know, we'd expect to get kind of reach in the millions for this one. Okay. It's a huge prize, yeah. This one, and part of it is kind of people creating videos and then sharing it on their social networks and things like that. So there's a fair bit of network effect happening in the campaign we're running now. But yeah, no, it's always a really good response.
What's your sort of demographic using your platform? Are we still talking? Is that sort of young millennials or sort of 20s or do you?
Yeah, that's the sweet spot. Yeah, 18 to 32 is like the sweet spot. But we've, you know, we've got users that sit outside that and you know, can still enjoy and use the platform and. But yeah, definitely that 18 to 32 millennial traveller is probably the sweet spot for us.
Assuming that you're not sending out emails via Outlook now with cut and pasting lists into email lists, yes. Into things, what do you guys use in terms of software to sort of manage the business and manage the marketing?
Well, Sam, we've actually, you know, once again, the joys of getting bigger. We've got Sam Lidner, who's, you know, a bit of a marketing guru, so he looks after most of this. But yeah. I think we use some fairly standard tools, you know, SendGrid for, you know, emails. And, you know, we still do a lot of the social ourselves. We don't really use, you know, the Hootsuites and yeah. things like that for a lot of our social. We still just jump in there. It's a bit ad hoc, but... you know, we still handle most of that sort of stuff. So we try to keep it fairly simple on the whole and not make things, you know, too complicated. But I think once again, you know, a bit like the jet story earlier, once we get bigger, things naturally yeah. become more complicated and you need to start to increase those efficiencies and things like that. But Sam does most of our, you know, we do run some ads on these days on Google and Facebook and all of those types of things. And Sam looks after all of that for us, which is great.
From a metrics point of view, are you guys numbers guys? I mean, do you like sort of get up every morning and go, how many new people have we got, or how long are they spending on the app? Is that important to you?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, definitely. It's got to be. So we keep a constant eye on, you know, our metrics and our key metrics just to know, you know, what's happening. We run a heap of experiments, you know, in the app. They're running all the time. So we like to see what effect they've had.
Give us an idea of an experiment that you would run in the app.
Just last week we changed the algorithm of our feed. Right. Because we were like, you know, we're starting to get more content coming in. So we need to make sure that, you know, what people are seeing from a first experience is quite curated, because we get a very, very different kind of feed to your typical social networks like Instagram and Facebook, because you're kind of coming on and seeing random content, because the whole idea of our app is connecting people that don't actually know each other. So it's not like Instagram where it's all your friends and Snapchat's your friends and Facebook's your friends. This is like people you don't know. So how do we make that content, you know, really attractive for people coming in? And so we do a heap of stuff with the algorithm, you know, in our feed, constantly playing with it. But just last week we kind of switched a few things up and pulled a few different levers, and we saw that I actually thought it was going to work quite well, but you know, basically like engagement, you know, likes, comments feed scrolls and things like that dropped by about 20% one day. So we just went, okay, let's undo that. And,
panic. Where's the undo button? Quickly.
Yeah, exactly. Undo. But so we do heaps of stuff like that, right down to the colors of buttons and all sorts of stuff.
Do you find that you get a bit too micro with it, or, you know?
We go through phases. So where we do, and then we go, hey, look, we really need to kind of test this out. So we're probably not too bad. I think we know the metrics that matter to us, and we kind of concentrate on optimizing those.
As we mentioned before we started, for everyone out there, I met you originally through a pitching event, River Pitch here in Brisbane. I just want to ask you, I mean, how many, you must have pitched the business a fair few times in the last, you know, the last few years.
Yes.
Do you enjoy it?
No. I enjoyed talking about the business, but, you know, pitching's kind of different. I think you've got to be a certain type of person to you know, enjoy that environment, you know, because it's yeah, it's pretty intense. You know, we've done some, you know, you were at that one. That was a big one. You know, you're in front of, you know, what, I don't know, 100, 150 people, yeah. And then it's just questions flying at you from, you know, left field of people that you don't know and don't know your business, and yeah. It's intense. So, you know, it's part of the process, but would I say I enjoy it? I don't think so.
The experience I had, and I know, to be fair, I've only ever done it once, and it was at that river pitch time.
Yeah.
But I find that, you know, people pick on small things within the presentation that you perhaps didn't even think about at the time why you put it in the presentation, and they're like, why have you put that logo in there, or why have you making that statement or that claim, and all of a sudden you're like, whoa, I wasn't quite ready for that.
That's right. And you know, the argument can kind of, well, not an argument, but the discussion can get diverted. I mean, that's a very kind of different forum, that river pitch, because it's like a, you know, it's a fairly public thing, so it's a bit different when you're kind of in a room with, you know, just one institution or one investor or things like that. And I'm kind of much more comfortable with that situation because I tend not to pitch and more, you know, discuss, more of a discussion rather than me presenting 10 slides in, you know, 4 minutes or whatever it might be. So that's the way we try to do it now. And I think it comes across a lot more naturally if you can talk through your business and be more conversational and have it less structured. And, you know, that's probably the way I prefer it.
I'm going to retract what I said earlier. I've actually done it twice. And the second time I got called out on the numbers, and fuck, I wasn't ready.
Yeah.
And I was like, and you know, and of course, immediately afterwards, you go, I had an answer to every question.
Yeah.
But I hadn't prepped myself to answer those questions.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's it. You always kind of, there'll always be something you'll get caught on. But whenever we're in that mode, we definitely do, you know, hit for homework and, you know, make sure we know all the numbers. The numbers are normally, like, I could talk through the business and strategy, you know, till the cows come home, but it's the numbers that, you know, generally people get caught up on. So it's a matter of knowing those and making sure you're across everything.
Would that be your number one tip for everybody else out there when they're standing up in a pitch, is to know the numbers?
I think so. Yeah, you've really got to know what they're going to dig into, and then dig into your own numbers a little bit more so you've got absolutely everything covered. Because I think most founders and most people pitching, like I said, can talk about, you know, their business and the strategy and the customers and all of those types of things, you know, pretty seamlessly and easily, you know, market size. But you really have to know those numbers because you know, they matter. It's what investors are investing on, and if you get them wrong, you kind of lose credibility pretty quickly.
Couple of getting towards the end here. I've got some final questions for you, but the one I kind of want to ask you is that if you went back and did all this again, and I know I've already sort of asked if you know do things, certain things differently, but what was perhaps the one skill that you would go back and go, you know what, I need to know that first. Is there any one thing that sort of stands out to you that you go, I would train myself more about that or learn more about that?
Look, I think kind of skills can always be learned, but I think you've got to, if you're going to become a startup founder, I think you need certain qualities. Right. I think there's intrinsic qualities that you need to be, because you can learn, you know, I'm a CEO now, but I still don't really even know what a CEO does, or am I doing it right? And, you know, I'm reading heaps and I'm learning heaps, but, you know, what do I do? Am I doing it right? I'm not sure. But all of those skills, I think, can be learned. But I think there's certain qualities that you've got to have in order to, you know, be able to learn those skills. And I think that's almost more important. And, you know, the typical ones of, you know, persistence and resilience and all of those types of things. Because the one thing I don't think I realized was how hard this was going to be. And I don't think a lot of people realize that. My friends don't realize how hard it is. And I don't think people before they start a startup know how hard it is. And that's why, you know, the vast, vast majority kind of give up at the end of the day. And, you know, it's generally, you know, that element of persistence and hanging in there and, you know, just grinding away and finding a way, that will be the difference in the end. And, you know, it seems to be the story I've read, you know, just about the biographies of just about every major startup going around, and it's a similar story for all of them. They struggled early. Very few of them, got the viral growth that you think they did. But they just found a way to do it. The Airbnb guys selling breakfast cereal.
Yes, that's a great story.
Obama cereal. Yeah. To get their first $50,000 and so on. What the hell? But they found a way.
Well, I always like the story about Uber is, and I forget his name now because I've just. But that was never a main gig for him. That was all. It was all a side gig for him as well at the time.
The
question I'm going to have to ask you, because you're a travel app, is your best and worst destinations that you personally like and dislike.
Best destinations probably, I traveled, so it's a continent, but traveled through Africa, and we kind of did. We kind of flew into Kenya and Nairobi and went up to Rwanda and worked our way over across 10 weeks down to Cape Town. It was just amazing. Like, I would go back there in an instant. I've got kids now and I want to go back there. I think it just gives you a really, really good perspective on life when you, it's such a beautiful country and the people are beautiful, but then you see some of the poverty and those sorts of things. It just puts a whole lot of stuff in perspective. So I think that's a really kind of good, probably my favourite place. The worst, I guess it's just on a scale because I like kind of travelling everywhere, but I guess there's some of those tourists, where was it, Rimini or some places like that in Italy that are like those tourist beaches where English people go to party and stuff, and I'm just going to the beaches are pebbles with like a million chairs on them, and you're just like, what the hell? I think you come from Australia and you go to those beaches and you're like, this isn't a beach. This is, I don't know what this is, but it's not good. Yeah. So, I mean, we still had some good nights there, don't get me wrong, but as far as kind of travel destinations, that was probably pretty average.
My last three questions. What are some of the other brands that you admire that you see out there that you aspire to sort of mimic or evolve into? And it could be anything, not necessarily apps or not necessarily travel brands, but absolutely anything. Or something that you buy a lot that you, obviously a lot of people always go Apple, but, other
examples. Yeah, I'm not really, I'm not really brand loyal to, like, there's nothing that I just obsess over from a brand. I've got to have this brand. In fact, I'm pretty unhappy with my iPhone at the moment, to be honest. But, I like the Virgin brand, and Richard Branson. I like what he did, what he stands for, how he's built his business, how it's evolved into all these different things. I like that. I like the fact that he started off with one thing and then seized a whole heap of opportunities, along the way. But the Virgin brand has kind of seeped into all of those different verticals. So he's probably a guy that I admire and a brand that I admire as well.
Second to last question, what's next for you guys? Is there what new features, what's the plan for this year, and perhaps longer term, is there an exit for you guys that you guys see, or is this something you see yourself running forever and ever, or because it strikes me as a brand, as an app that a bigger travel company would want to acquire at some point.
So the answer to the first question, what's next, is there's some really exciting stuff coming up. We're starting to kind of explore some new technology, around blockchain and converting some kind of legacy stuff that's happening in travel possibly onto blockchain and looking at the way that works and how that could affect travel, because I think it's a new technology that I don't think is going away, and we kind of want to be at the forefront of that. So we're looking into a whole heap of kind of different projects there that could be really, really exciting. For us, we I know it's everyone's like, you need to have an exit plan. You need to know how you're going to get out before you get in. But, we are kind of enjoying this. We're enjoying the process. We like what we're doing. We're in social and we're in travel. So it's two pretty cool places to be in. So we just want to continue what we're doing, and we don't, we're not doing this to flip it or to exit, but if an opportunity comes along, then we'll kind of look at it. But we want to create a global brand here. That's what we want to do. Whether we do that by piggybacking off somebody else or whether we can build that ourselves kind of remains to be seen. And that's the adventure over the next kind of, 1 to 2 years for us. But we're certainly not doing it to, you know, to get bought by a bigger company. That's not the aim of what we're doing here.
Is there another raise sort of in the pipeline?
Yeah, there is actually. So we're in the middle of it at the moment. So all of your pitching questions are on point. And, you know, it's going okay. Yeah. We're getting a good response. You know, we've got probably one of the most difficult fundraisers to do in Australia because, you know, we're a consumer-facing social network, which is incredibly difficult to pitch to guys who are used to investing in, you know, houses or SaaS platforms or, you know, mining and things like that. But it's going well. You just got to find the right people who kind of believe in the bigger picture and, you know, get them on board.
Final question. If people want to come and talk to you, if they want to ask any questions in the travel industry or even in the startup and ask more tips for your pitching as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
Where's the best place for them to come and find you?
Yeah, probably like you can just contact me through LinkedIn. You can just find me on there, Ryan Hanley Travello app, or, you know, email's fine as well. I'm fine with that. If people want to reach out, it's just ryan@travelloapp.com. So they're probably the easiest two ways.
Cool. Brilliant, mate. Thank you very much for your stories and your advice today. And I'm sure a lot of people will go and be downloading the app today and following your progress. So thank you for spending time with me today.
Pleasure, Simon. Appreciate it.
Cheers.
Thanks, mate.
That's pretty much it for episode number 30 of the Simon Dell Show. Thank you for tuning in. It was a pleasure to have you along with the journey today. We hope you listen in next week. Final point, final notice, if you do want to get in contact, simon@simondell.com or www.simondell.com. Come and find me on LinkedIn. Come and find me on Twitter. We'd love to have a chat with you. Thanks very much for tuning in.